Before we begin this podcast, I'd like to tell you about a special deal. Subscribe today to The Spectator for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with, here's the magic bit, a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. This year, 2024, is an election year in America, a presidential election year. And so we will be doing two podcasts a week rather than our usual one because we want to and because we know you can't get enough Americano in your life. I am delighted to be joined today by the diplomat and author Dennis B. Ross, who worked under President H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton and was a special advisor on the Persian Gulf. And we're going to be talking about the most dramatic story of the week, which is, of course, the escalation of tensions in the Middle East. Dennis, Joe Biden is getting a lot of flack, right and left, on his foreign policy in the Middle East this week. And it does seem a lot like he keeps saying things to people, like he says to Iran, don't do something, and they do it. And he says to Israel, show restraint, and they don't. Is it fair to say America is losing its ability to shape events in the Middle East?
Well, I guess what I would say is this is not the first time we've told countries either to do something or not to do something, and they haven't responded to us. So as if the U.S. has always been able to sort of dictate what others will do, that's never been true, number one. Number two, it is fair to say that U.S. power is more constrained than it's been historically. It's fair to say that we are not the uber power. This is not a unipolar world. But there is no other country that is more powerful than the United States, and there's probably no other country that is as influential as the United States. So I think that still remains to be the case.
Yes. And when it comes to Iran, do you think a lot of the criticism of Joe Biden is fair? Because he seems to have gone along with the Trump-era policy of bringing Israel closer to the Gulf states, the Abraham Accords and so on, and also creating strategic alliance between Israel and Saudi Arabia, which might lead to an accord of its own. At the same time, Biden has tried to warm up relations with Iran, loosening sanctions and so on. And it appears these two slightly contradictory policies have blown up in his face.
Well, I think it's interesting. I'm finishing up a new book in which I go back and I trace every administration's approach to Iran since the Iranian Revolution, since 1979. And there isn't one American administration that has a successful policy with Iran. Every single one had variations of the same theme, which was basically, we will put pressure on you, but we will reach out to you. The only administration that was somewhat different was probably the George H.W. Bush administration, which inherited a policy right after Iran-Contra where the basic approach was hands-off. But every other administration effectively tried to change Iran's behavior and for the most part did not succeed. So to somehow single again Biden out, there isn't another administration that you can point to that had great success. Ironically, if you look for an administration where something was achieved, although with profound limitations, you could say the Obama administration. They achieved two things. The Iranians said they wouldn't negotiate if they were under sanctions. We tripled down on the sanctions, and guess what? They negotiated. The JCPOA was produced, which actually put a constraint on Iran's nuclear behavior, but it also seemed to free up their belief that they are much freer to engage in aggressive behavior within the region. So yes, on the one hand, Iran's behavior was affected on the nuclear issue, but not in a way that required Iran to give up an ambition. It certainly preserved the option to have a nuclear weapon somewhere down the road. On the other hand, basically, it certainly deferred that ambition for at least 15 years. So you could say that was an achievement, but it came with a price that they felt freer to do much more in the region. And with sanctions being lifted, they had more resources to do it. So it's very hard to identify any administration that succeeded. The Trump administration certainly didn't succeed. They pulled out of the JCPOA, and the Iranians then began to violate all the limits imposed in the JCPOA. Iran became more aggressive in the region, not less aggressive in the region. So the Trump administration's approach to so-called maximum pressure didn't produce anything. So it's hard to identify any administration that has succeeded vis-a-vis the Iranians.
How do you measure Iran becoming more aggressive in the region? Is it incidents involving its proxies? How does one gauge that?
It's a good question, but I guess my answer would be they built up their proxies. They greatly enhanced their military capabilities. They greatly enhanced their ability. In the case of Hamas, what they did over time is they built the Hamas military-industrial base. That was the Revolutionary Guard and Hezbollah together. All the Shia militias in Iraq, same thing. Who built up their indigenous capabilities? The Iranians did. Hezbollah is much more powerful, again, supported to the tune of about $1 billion a year by Iran. They became more powerful over time. So all of these proxies gained greater capability, and the Iranians used the proxies more to try to engage in coercion and intimidation. And you know, one last point on this. It's interesting. Iran came to describe its forward defense boundary as being in Lebanon. And that wasn't the case always. So, you know, you look at the Houthis, maybe the Houthis weren't created by the Iranians, but they now have an ability to produce a lot of their own missiles, and that came from Iran, the Revolutionary Guard, and Hezbollah.
Do you think now, with events last weekend and Israel threatening a retaliatory strike, the War Cabinet says, in coordination with the United States, do you think we are now on an inevitable path towards conflict, major conflict between Iran and Israel, or are there off-ramps?
We have a reality where neither side wants an all-out war with the other. Iran signaled in advance what it was going to do. It didn't say exactly what it was going to strike, but it gave Israel plenty of forewarning, gave the U.S. plenty of forewarning. This, but for those who say, you see, Iran really didn't intend to do anything. No, you don't launch 360 projectiles and rockets in another country with the aim is just to make a statement. You want to make a statement, you allow 10 or 15. 360, you intended to inflict real damage. You wanted to do it in a way that kept this from turning into an all-out war. But this was not about just making a statement. The fact that they failed completely. There were only four ballistic missile penetrations, a lot of failed ballistic missile launches by the Iranians. The reality is neither side may want a war, but when you signal with force, you make a war more likely. And what we've seen is there was a shadow war going on between Israel and Iran, and the Iranians decided to take it out of the shadows. Why did they do it? I think mostly because they lost some senior Revolutionary Guard officers in as a result of an Israeli strike in Damascus. That followed another strike 3 weeks earlier in which the Israelis took out another general of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. Israel has obviously been engaged in an effort to interdict the Iranian ability to supply Hezbollah and provide advanced weapons to Hezbollah. It was the killing of the Revolutionary Guard in Damascus that triggered the Iranian decision. Okay, now there's going to be a price, and we're going to show we're going to change the ground rules. The ground rules are you are not allowed to attack our officials in Syria. Now, from an Israeli standpoint, leaving aside the issue of you're going to attack us directly from your territory and you think it doesn't draw a response, there's even something else. Israel is basically saying, you think you can deploy these Revolutionary Guard people in forward positions and they can plan on a daily basis attacks against us and they can do it with impunity? Think again. So the Israelis are not going to allow Iran to redefine the ground rules. And the Iranians want to show that they're going to protect their Revolutionary Guard, who they deploy not for defensive purposes, but for offensive purposes. So Iran has some choices to make too.
You mentioned Iran bringing the war out of the shadows with the strike last weekend, But I mean, you could argue from what you've just said that Israel's been hastening the conflict, and a lot of people are very suspicious about what Netanyahu's motives are for doing so. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, Israel has had a campaign of what they call the war between the wars. And so as they see Iran doing everything it can to build up Hezbollah's capabilities against Israel, Hezbollah needs 150,000 rockets. And Iran was trying to give them terminal guidance. You know, Iran was built up the Houthis, and the Houthis are firing at Israel, not just ships, but at Israel as well. Iran is declaring, Israel's not saying that it's going to destroy Iran. Iran is saying Israel won't exist in 25 years. Supreme leader calls it a cancer and says it won't exist in 25 years. And Iran was never, in my mind, they want the capability to have a nuclear weapon, not necessarily to use it against Israel because it knows what it would draw in response. But the strategy Iran has through its proxies is to make Israel unlivable. And so what is Israel supposed to do? They're supposed to accept that? I don't think so. I don't think any country would. Certainly they won't, and certainly not given Jewish history they won't.
You mentioned how every administration you can think of, except for possibly H.W. Bush, has failed in its objectives with Iran. One objective of the Obama administration, I think other administrations, has been to foster revolution in Iran that would bring down the Ayatollahs, bring down the Islamic Republic as it stands. Do you think that war, if war breaks out between Israel and Iran, could that hasten the demise of the regime? Because we hear a lot about opposition in Tehran and so on.
I'm always dubious that you change regimes by imposing force. Certainly we remove Saddam Hussein, and you can say, and what exactly did we produce in its place? Even what Israel is doing in Gaza right now, it's creating a vacuum. If there isn't something to fill the vacuum other than Hamas or groups like Hamas, maybe you've destroyed their military, but you haven't destroyed the idea that rejects Israel that would be still based within Gaza. I think regime change is always problematic from the outside. If regime change is going to come, it comes from the inside. Now, what is true is that nothing more motivates the supreme leader than regime survival. Nothing. And one of the reasons he has historically been very hesitant about getting in direct confrontations, especially with us, is the concern that the regime might not survive that. Now, what that reflects is an understanding the regime is decidedly unpopular. And he has made it even less popular because of the response, I think, to the killing of Mahsa Amini and the fact that they continue to impose the hijab. And that there are penalties on women and business establishments that will serve women who have the hijab. Profoundly unpopular within the country. And the regime, basically since 2017, every year, on an annual basis, not necessarily predictable in terms of timing, but predictable in terms of reactions to moves the government makes, or the regime makes on the economy, which continues to be one where most of the Iranian middle class continues to decrease in size. The cost of living goes up, their savings go down, inflation is this constant tax on them all, devaluation of the currency imposes a penalty on all, and the level of corruption with the regime remains very high. You know, the Revolutionary Guard, those within the regime, they don't suffer, but everybody else does. So there is, and we saw it in the reaction to the Women, Life, Freedom movement, that this was across the board. You know, historically, this is a regime that basically had support in the countryside, more devout in the countryside, more religious in the countryside. And we can see even there, the Women, Life, Freedom movement, it touched every part of Iran. It touched every social class within Iran. And the, you know, the supreme leader is someone who doesn't compromise in the face of pressure, except on the outside if he thinks that the pressure is really threatening. So do I think we can change the regime? I'm very dubious that we can change the regime. But I'm not dubious of the Supreme Leader being concerned that if they get into a conflict that could be highly costly, that it could unleash forces within the country that he's afraid of.
Well, I mean, one thing that could change is Khomeini himself. He's 84. People talk a lot about Joe Biden being too old. How long can he live? I accept that his son might take over, or something perhaps even more theocratic and worse might take over. What's your analysis on that?
You know, I don't think we can ever bet on exactly what the biological longevity is going to end up being. When I first went into the government, it was during the Carter administration, and I would read all these things about Khomeini, and he had literally every malady. He had diabetes, he had heart disease, he had hardening of the arteries. I mean, there wasn't a malady he didn't have, and he lived for almost another 10 years. So, you know, it's the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, is actually 85. He does suffer from prostate cancer, but prostate cancer can be a very slow-growing kind of cancer. We don't know if it basically was arrested or not. There have been periods when he disappeared from view, and that fed all sorts of speculation. But he's been out there quite publicly in the last 6 months, so I don't know that we can count on that. I do think the moment of real stress for that regime is going to come when he dies. Authoritarian regimes are always under great stress during periods of succession, partly because there aren't necessarily clear rules about what succession is, partly because there are competitors who decide this is their moment, partly because it creates a dissonance within the elite. And you need the unanimity and the strong consensus and unity of elite to create a kind of common face to the public. Because you could have a public in those circumstances that says, oh, we have a moment now. Now, the irony is if you look at these kinds of periods, there's also a tendency to have a competition between those who think they need to come in and they need to relax the approach towards the public as a way of building some authority for themselves. There could be a real competition when Khamenei goes. And the idea that is, you know, that Mojtaba, his son, could be a replacement, I think that feeds almost a guarantee that there'll be resistance within the upper reaches of the elite of different institutions, because this is not a monarchy. This is the Islamic Republic. So, you know, his son's going to replace him. So what? It is a monarchy.
Yeah. A lot of talk in the last few years. I think the last time you came on the podcast, we talked about this a lot, about the thawing of relations between Israel and the Gulf states, the Abraham Accords, brokered under President Trump, and how that has changed the dynamics of the Middle East and realigned the Arab states. And we saw a little bit of this over the weekend when, you know, Jordan was involved in bringing down the missiles from Iran, which is quite an extraordinary, historically, that's an extraordinary development. The Abraham Accords themselves seem to be an extraordinary diplomatic breakthrough. I wonder, though, do you think in creating this, perhaps it's Sunni-Shia divide, rather than leading towards peace, which is what normally happens when you broker accords, what we might be doing is creating two very antagonistic rival blocs that are inevitably bound for conflict?
That may be the reality that's emerging right now. But again, I think you have to, one of those blocks is actually designed to preserve stability and order in the region. And the other one is designed to transform the regional order and have Iran become the hegemonic power. And I would simply say for people of the Middle East, wherever Iran is seen as dominant, has influence, you have either a failed state, a failing state, or a state completely paralyzed. They refer to themselves as the axis of resistance. I refer to them as the axis of misery. Nobody in any of those states have any sense of possibility or hope, no sense that they have a future that could be more promising. So, you know, it's not an accident that you might be seeing the emergence of what is a regional coalition designed to protect against that and to counter that. What is different is that Israel is actually a part of it. That wasn't the case historically. Iran is still trying to exploit the Palestinian issue as a way of preventing that coalition from emerging. And actually, it becomes an argument for, if you have a Saudi breakthrough with Israel, it's based on Israel having to make some concessions on the Palestinian issue that this particular Israeli government wouldn't be able to take unless it falls, unless it breaks apart. Clearly, the Biden administration is hoping to get enough of a pause with what's going on in Gaza that the Saudis might be prepared to finalize a normalization deal. They won't finalize it unless there's a pause in Gaza. But if they finalize it, it will be based on Israel having to commit to certain things vis-a-vis the Palestinians that would break this government apart. Now, would Prime Minister Netanyahu go ahead and do that? You know, right now, his legacy today is October 7th, the worst day in Israel's history. But a legacy of having negotiated a breakthrough, achieved a breakthrough with Saudi Arabia, a transformative event in the Middle East, a transformative dynamic to change the release, to change the region as we've known it, that would be a pretty remarkable legacy.
And if there were to be regime change in Tehran, and it ended up being favorable to the West, to Israel, and so on, would that possibly be a problem for this alliance against Iran? Because the one thing that binds it together is suspicion of enmity towards the regime in Tehran and what they're doing in the region.
I don't think, I mean, look, there will be suspicion of most of the Arab states towards the Iranians, even if there is regime change. It'll take time to get over it. What does regime change mean? If let's say the Revolutionary Guard replaces the Supreme Leader and this becomes much less the Islamic Republic and much more, you know, the Persian state of Iran, where secularism and nationalism becomes a source of identity, is that going to change Iran's ambitions in the region? Maybe in some respects, but it will still want to be a dominant power. There's almost a kind of imperative here that Iran wants to be the dominant power in the region. Now, maybe you can go through a transition. Maybe you have, I mean, if you're saying if there was a democratic government that truly emerged in Iran, would that change the character of how others would see it? You know, I think most Arab leaders would want to see performance by Iran that would show that it wants to be a good neighbor now, and it's not interested in being a dominant neighbor. I don't think regime change, unless it was transformative and suddenly it becomes a democracy and they're a liberal democracy and they have only interest in good neighborly relations for real, not just in terms of slogans. I think it takes time for others to become convinced that Iran is not going to be a threat to them and is actually prepared to be a good neighbor. Look, would they like it to be a good neighbor? The answer is yes. Do they anticipate it being one? I think there's a kind of built-in hesitancy to see the proof.
But given that America is trying to establish more friendly relations with the Gulf states and trying to establish more friendly relations between Israel and the Gulf states, who are, you know, autocracies, I accept that there are some moves towards liberalization and so on. Iran doesn't have to become a sort of, you know, all singing, all dancing democracy for the dynamics to change entirely.
What I'm saying to you is the idea that we're going to have a regime change and it's a light switch and suddenly we go from a dark, threatening regime to a regime that is neat, clean, loves puppies and loves children. You know, I have a hard time envisioning that's what we're going to see anytime soon in Iran. If it were to take place, if there really is a revolution in Iran that brings Democrats, liberal Democrats to bear, Iran could be, you know, then you could see a very different kind of set of coalitions emerge. Look, there, Iran and Israel had a relationship under the Shah. You know, I think the Iranian people may be the least among the populations in the region, least hostile to Israel, partly because they don't like the regime, and they know the Israelis don't like the regime. But I think the Iran has this enormous potential. I mean, it has a large population, a literate, educated population, a cultured population, and suddenly you could see an Israeli-Iranian relationship that serves both sides and is transformed from the standpoint of the region. It's just hard for me to see that kind of change in Iran anytime soon. I see the potential for a move from the again a religiously based, at least in theory, in terms of name, to a much more nationalistic regime. If the Revolutionary Guard emerges and you have a more militarized regime, which could be the case, I think it may be a more nationalistic one. But a more nationalistic one doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be any less assertive.
And lastly, Dennis, I probably should have brought this up before, we haven't really talked about Russia and China, who, of course, are very important players in this escalation. If they are propping up Iran, is it fair to say they are the reason why Iran feels bolder to do things like attack Israel in the way they do? And if so, how do you avoid a conflict when an escalating conflict when there are two major powers behind the power that you're trying to contain?
I think they are bolstering it. I think it does make the Iranians feel more confident. There is, however, even though the Chinese and the Russian positions seem to be very similar, and the Chinese, unlike in the past, who always like to be sort of in the middle of conflicts, meaning that they don't create antagonisms from either side. They want to look like we have friends with both sides. The Chinese have been defending the Iranians, just like the Russians, that what they did in the attack of Israel, they portray as being self-defense. Having said that, 47% of China's oil comes through the Strait of Hormuz. They are the world's biggest importer of oil. Do you really think they want to see a blow up in the Middle East? They don't. They can't afford it. Their economy right now, the economic growth is at a low ebb in China. Economic growth is sort of part of the social contract that the Communist Party there has with the public, meaning you grant us complete control over how of the political space that you can operate in, and in return, we allow you to improve your quality of life. Well, that's a harder and harder contract to be able to sustain right now. And the last thing they need is a blow up in the Middle East, unlike Putin. Putin would love to have a massive war in the Middle East, drives the price of oil up, you know, well over $100 a barrel. Great for Russia, terrible for China, the world's biggest importer of oil. Diversion of attention away from Ukraine, great for Russia, not so great for China. When it comes to the issue of conflict, they have very different interests. Whether it comes to China supporting Russia in general because they're part of the anti-American effort to ensure there aren't American-dominated rules internationally, they support them. And also I see it as being, you know, just like Iran challenges the regional order, that's okay with China, provided it doesn't produce a war in the region. So I think there's a divergence of interest there, and there's a potential to play on it.
And I suppose that gives the West an opportunity to peel Russia away from China in a way that Ukraine has done the opposite. The war in Ukraine seems to have brought China and Russia closer together.
I definitely think there's a potential for that.
Dennis Ross, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for coming onto the Americano podcast.
Always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
That's all for this episode of the Americano podcast. I'd like to thank my brilliant producer, Natasha Farrows, and urge you to leave a generous, kind and warm-hearted review of this podcast on whichever platform you listen to it.